shape of a manifold by specifying the non-triviality of parallel transport. So as you parallel transport a vector on the manifold and eventually return from your trip to the starting point, then this vector that you parallel transported may have experienced a rotation. If the space on which you do this is flat, it will not experience a rotation. If the space is curved, there can be a rotation. So that is what we set out to show, that we can specify the shape of a manifold in this way. For this purpose, we started defining the affine connection, which tells us how a vector changes direction as we parallel transport it, especially the derivative of the vector, so the rate of change of the direction of the vector as we parallel transport it. But this is not quite yet of the form that we wanted to have it. We wanted to extract from this non-triviality of parallel transport the actual curvature itself. Now, for that purpose, we will have to define what curvature is in the first place. And then we will have to relate the notion of curvature to the parallel transport and to the affine connection. So the first question we will ask is, how does the affine connection, the notion of differentiation of a vector as you parallel transport it, determine the shape? And by shape, we mean the notion of curvature. In fact, automatically, we will also have to consider the notion of torsion. So we will introduce that as well. Once we have the connection between the covariant derivative and the curvature, we will remember that there was another way of defining how a manifold looks like, namely through the metric. And we will ask, how does all of this, the affine connection and the curvature, how does that relate to the metric? So for now, we are still forgetting that there is a metric on the manifold. All we know on the manifold is the affine connection. And then we ask, how does the affine connection determine the curvature and torsion? So we start with this notion of torsion that you may or may not be familiar with. Who's familiar with torsion? Anybody? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Great. Okay, so assume that psi 1 and psi 2 are tangent vectors at the point of the point P of the manifold. And we define the so-called torsion map. What it does is, it takes the two tangent vectors and maps them into a tangent vector. Concretely, the two tangent vectors psi 1 and psi 2 are mapped into this thing. This is the outcome of the torsion map, which is concretely defined as the covariant derivative of psi 2 in the direction of psi 1 minus the covariant derivative of psi 1 in the direction of psi 2 minus the commutator between the two vector fields. Remember what the commutator means? A vector field applied to a function gives you a function again. And then you can apply another vector field to that. And if you do that in both sequences, then you get the commutator of the two vector fields. So it's really just psi 1, psi 2, minus psi 2, psi 1, where the product is understood as concatenation. Apply one after the other on the function in question. This torsion map, which operates in this way, we now use to define the so-called torsion tensor. The torsion tensor will be a 1-2 tensor. It will be one-fold contravariant, two-fold covariant. Namely, in order to define it, we have to say what the output of this tensor is if we feed it one covariant vector that will eat up this contravariant component, and if we feed it two contravariant vectors, which will eat up those two covariant components. And then the outcome of that should be a number. Right? So we can specify a 1-2 tensor by saying what number it gives us if we feed it one covariant, an arbitrary covariant vector to eat up this, and two arbitrary contravariant vectors to eat up those two components. And the torsion tensor is defined in this way. If you feed it a covariant vector and two contravariant vectors to eat up those, then you obtain the number that comes out from this calculation. You take the tangent map. So that is a tangent vector here, because the tangent, the torsion map takes two vectors and maps them into one vector. So this is a tangent vector, and then it is evaluated against this cotangent vector here.
The same as that for the torsion tensor, or?
Yes, well, that is meant to be a smaller symbol than that. But other than that, it's a tau, it's a small tau.
But the torsion map is different from the torsion tensor, slightly.
Yes, yes, because that's a tensor and that is a map. So how does that look like concretely if we want to choose coordinates? Well, let's say we choose a coordinate system, we choose a chart, and let's say we choose as the basis of the tangent vectors, those basis vectors, and as the basis of the cotangent vectors, those basis vectors. Remember that we don't have to choose those basis, they're just convenient because they are immediate to write down once you have a coordinate system. Then, if we take the torsion map and we feed it two tangent vectors, we get a tangent vector out of this. Remember, that's what the tangent map, the torsion map does. It feeds on two tangent vectors and gives you a tangent vector out. So we feed two tangent vectors, so we choose basis vectors because we want to know how this torsion tensor looks like in the basis, so we feed it basis vectors. And so that thing here is a tangent vector. We evaluate that against a cotangent vector. This is what the torsion as a tensor does. Right? So this is just concretely what we had there. I choose the canonical basis, those guys, for this, get a tangent vector, which I then evaluate against the canonical basis vector among the one-forms, among the covariant tensors, namely that. That's just exactly what we do here. So we can write that with this bracket. Dx, this cotangent vector, is evaluated against this tangent vector here. And concretely, this is the tangent map of that, which, if you remember, is simply this. It's the covariant derivative of this vector in the direction of that vector minus the other way around, minus the commutator of the two. Okay, let me just show you again. This was the definition of the tangent map, of the torsion map. It feeds on two tangent vectors and gives you a tangent vector by covariant differentiating the first with this in the direction of the second, minus the other way around, minus the commutator of the two. And here, xi1 and xi2 are chosen to be d by dxi and d by dxj. So that means we have to evaluate this thing here. But remember that those things were the basic Christoffel symbols. And the commutator of those basis vectors vanishes, because those basis vectors don't have coefficient functions in front, which could be non-trivially differentiated by the other derivative. So that thing is vanishing, just because partial derivatives vanish, assuming that the function is differentiable. So what we obtain is that all of this reduces simply to the evaluation of this basis covariant vector against the Christoffel symbol here, times, well, the Christoffel symbols are the coefficients of this tangent vector in that basis. And also this is, of course, a tangent vector, and the coefficients are given by this gamma here. So now we have to evaluate this basis vector against that basis vector, and here this one against that one. These things are just functions in front of everything. Those, of course, are evaluating to give us Kronecker deltas. And therefore, we obtain that the torsion tensor has those components if we choose the basis of the tangent and cotangent spaces that comes along with the coordinate system. If we had chosen another basis, we would have got another formula. But if we choose this basis, no, in particular, this stuff wouldn't have dropped out. So that's not really a universal equation here. It's an equation that holds for this choice of basis. And what we see here is that in this case, with this choice of basis, the torsion tensor, the components of the torsion tensor, are the anti-symmetric component of the Christoffel symbol. See, every matrix, and we can hold K fixed, then this is a matrix in I and J, the Christoffel symbol. Every matrix can be trivially decomposed into a symmetric part, a part that is into a matrix that is symmetric in I and J, plus a matrix that is anti-symmetric in I and J. Trivial decomposition. And what we see here is that the torsion part is the anti-symmetric part. Namely, if we take the Christoffel symbol, then we can write it as a symmetric part. So this is invariant under exchanging I and J. And an anti-symmetric part. This is anti-symmetric in I and J, and it's half of the torsion tensor. And if you add the two, you see that these two terms drop out, and that just becomes the Christoffel symbol. So the Christoffel symbol is really just the sum of the symmetric and this anti-symmetric part, as I indicated before. Now, this tells us already something about the symmetric part as well. The torsion tensor is a tensor. And this means that the anti-symmetric component of the Christoffel symbol is a tensor. But we know already from a consideration of the last lecture that the full Christoffel symbol is not a tensor. It doesn't transform properly. So this already tells us that the symmetric component of the Christoffel symbol cannot be transforming as a tensor. In general relativity, we will require that the affine connection is torsionless. We will require that the torsion tensor vanishes. Let us see why we want to impose that. There's much to be said about why torsion may or may not play a role in physics, and I will give you just a little bit of a hint, and you're invited to perhaps expand that into an essay if you want. It's one of those essay topics. So why would we want to require in general relativity that the torsion tensor is vanishing? Then we can work with an extended equivalence principle. You see, the Christoffel symbol's gamma will express gravitational and pseudo forces. They will express tidal forces, and they will also express the forces that you experience when you are accelerating around on a on a carnival ride. So the gamma expresses all those gravitational and pseudo forces. And the equivalence principle says that locally, you want special relativity to hold. At every point of space-time, if we look at a sufficiently small region around that point, then physics in that small region should be indistinguishable from physics governed by special relativity. And that should mean that the gamma should, we should be able to make the gamma vanish. The Collins principle should say that around every point of the space-time manifold, there ought to be a region, and there ought to be a choice of coordinate system such that in this region, or at the very least at this, at the point that we are considering in this region, the gamma vanishes. So there are no gravitational or pseudo forces, and everything is governed by ordinary special relativity. That, however, if we buy into this argument, namely that the local validity of special relativity means the vanishing of gamma, then we have to conclude that the torsion vanishes at every point of the manifold. To see this, let us study those coordinate systems in which the equations of motion for an object moving in space-time are closest to those of special relativity. So what we do is we say the space-time might be curved. It might have all sorts of non-trivial features. But the equivalence principle requires that locally we can always find a coordinate system such that things look nearly like special relativity. And in fact, arbitrarily closely like special relativity, as long as we make the region that we consider small enough and we choose the coordinate system appropriately. Now, the best coordinate system you can ever choose to make the loss look as close as possible to special relativity are the so-called geodesic or normal coordinates. These will be the coordinate systems in which we minimize the tidal forces and the combination of the tidal forces and the pseudo forces. Let's assume psi is a tangent vector. Then remember that we say that psi is, or a tangent vector field. We say that psi is also parallel to a path gamma if the derivative of the tangent vector field along the path, on the path, is vanishing. So what it means is we have a path in the space-time, and at every point of this path, we have a tangent vector, gamma dot, which is pointing in the direction of the path. Now we look at the vector field psi. And we look at the vector field psi at a point of this path. And we differentiate psi in the direction that the path is taking there. And psi is not supposed to change, which is to say that the parallel transport of the vector field psi along this path is trivial. The derivative is always vanishing. The vector field is not changing according to the affine connection as you travel along that path. And that is what is meant by psi is also parallel. And this is the case if that equation holds. Remember, we derived that equation. And we discussed that because of results from the theory of ordinary differential equations, we can always solve this equation, at least in some finite region. Now, a curved gamma that describes a path is called geodesic if its own tangent vector, its own tangent vector field, is also parallel along gamma. This is to say that the path gamma is the geodesic if the derivative of the tangent vector in the direction of the tangent vector is vanishing all along the path. That's what makes it a geodesic. And from this equation, we can read off what that means. And so in the case of a geodesic, the vector field that needs to be orthoparallel is gamma dot, which in coordinates is simply dx by dt. But remember, t is not the time. T is just the parameter along the geodesic. In special circumstances, it may be the time, but it generally it isn't. Okay, so we have to use this autoparallelity equation, and instead of an arbitrary vector field psi, we're using the vector gamma dot, which is dx by dt. And therefore, if we replace psi by dx by dt, we obtain this equation, and that's the equation for geodesic. Again, from the theory of ordinary differential equations, we can conclude that for any point P of the of our smooth manifold, and any initial condition, that is any initial velocity vector that we may specify at that point, this differential equation can be integrated for at least some finite distance in both directions, and will give us a geodesic, therefore. So at every point, choosing a direction, we get a geodesic. And we can use the following notation. Gamma index psi means this is the path that is started out by this initial condition psi. So that's the initial velocity that the path starts with. So if gamma psi of t solves our geodesic equation, then we observe the following. Then gamma psi of lambda t also solves this geodesic equation. And that's just because of the linearity of the derivative here. And so what we can conclude from that is that a gamma of lambda psi of t is gamma of psi of lambda t. What does that mean? Intuitively, it means that if you start your path with an initial velocity vector that is changed by a factor of lambda, so lambda, let's say, is a big number, then your initial velocity vector is still in the same direction as before, but it is much faster, then you're going through the same geodesic, but faster by a factor of lambda. So if you start your geodesic with a slow velocity vector psi, and you run through it faster, you get what you obtain when you take the ordinary calculated geodesic with a faster velocity vector. So it simply says that the speed is set at the beginning. And I invite you to verify that this is the same here. Now we can define the exponential map. That would be a crucial concept here. It's crucial for many things, in particular for defining the geodesic coordinate system, normal coordinates, which, remember, I promised to be that coordinate system which gets closest to describing the manifold locally as if it was governed by special relativity. Consider a fixed point P of the manifold. Then the exponential map is defined in the following way. It will map tangent vectors at the point P, which you can view as initial velocity vectors that give you the initial condition for in which direction a geodesic should shoot off. So it feeds on an initial velocity vector. And then as the output, the exponential map gives you a point of the manifold. So the exponential map is associated to a point of the manifold, to a starting point P of the manifold. So we hold P fixed. This P is later going to be the center of our geodesic coordinate system. So this point P is arbitrary, but we hold it fixed. Then the exponential map takes tangent vectors at the point P and gives us for every tangent vector a point somewhere else on the manifold. And it does it in the following way. The exponential map of the point P takes a tangent vector in the tangent space to P and maps it into the point that you arrive at if you follow the geodesic with initial velocity psi until the geodesic parameter reaches 1. So you shoot off a bullet with velocity psi and let it run for 1 second. It's just a, doesn't have units, this thing. It's just a pure number. Which means that if you take a point psi, if you take a vector psi at the tangent, in the tangent space to P, and feed it into the exponential map, you get some point far away, well, depends on how far, but some distance away, and you get it by just following the geodesic that has the initial velocity psi. Now, if you took the initial velocity psi and multiplied it with a factor of 27 or so, then your geodesic would shoot off 27 times as fast. And therefore, by the time the parameter of the geodesic reaches the value 1, it'll be much further out. Okay? So what you see is that small vectors psi will be mapped into nearby points of P. Large vectors psi will be mapped into far away points. Points that are far away from P.
If I understand, you're going along a geodesic which is in the direction of psi.
That's correct. Yes. The geodesic starts out with tangent vector psi and then runs until its internal parameter reaches 1. So, for example, if you flip the sign of psi, you shoot up in the other direction. Now, from this equation that we had above, G, this equation, which says that if you shoot the bullet off faster, you reach further linearly, from that equation, we obtain that gamma of psi of lambda is gamma of lambda psi of 1. Because you can either have the factor here or down there. It's the same by this equation G. This we can now identify as the exponential map of lambda psi. That's very trivial. But keep it in mind. So what are geodesic coordinates? We want to build a coordinate system, a custom-made coordinate system, around a chosen point P. And we use the exponential map for that. Remember that the exponential map maps tangent vectors at P into points of the manifold. Now, the tangent space, the tangent vector at P, the tangent vector space at the point P is a vector space. As such, it is Rn, right? Tangent vectors Rn, which is a manifold. And the exponential map is a diffeomorphism, meaning an invertible, differentiable map, from this manifold Rn, the tangent vector space, into a neighborhood of the point P in M. In practice, the exponential map may not map all of Rn into all of the manifolds, maybe just a little point. Can you tell why that might be so, that we can't pull this off really for all of the tangent vector space and map this into all of the manifolds?
Differ from region to region?
No, no. The point is, any other guesses?
Some pieces, disjoint pieces of manifold. Or
well, that's one possibility, but it's also a possibility that there might be some regions of the manifold that you can reach with no geodesic from the point P.
Connectedness, like they are not connected.
Yeah, they're not connected by geodesics, could be. And another possibility is that geodesics cross. Yeah, all sorts of things can happen. And so if the geodesics cross, it can't be invertible.
Because then you reach the same point of the manifold far away with two different geodesics. Right? You couldn't have the spaces suitably geodesic, suitably curved. You could have the two geodesics end up at the same point. All right, but if we restrict attention to a small neighborhood, sufficiently small neighborhood, it may still be enormous, but
sufficiently small neighborhood of the origin in Rn in the tangent space, and a sufficiently small piece of the manifold around the point P, then we should be fine, or we will be fine. One can prove this on the grounds of the general properties of differential equations. And then, therefore, the exponential map actually provides us with a chart. Because what is a chart? What is the coordinate system? Right? It is a map from Rn into the manifold, or from the manifold into Rn. It has to be a differentiable, invertible map. And that's what it does. We have two manifolds here, a piece of Rn and a piece of the manifold, differentiable map in between them. That's going to be a chart. So for example, we can now choose the basis in the tangent space at the point P, some basis in this space. Then we know that the tangent vector psi is a linear combination of those basis vectors. Then, you see, as soon as you choose those coefficients psi i, you have chosen psi, and therefore the exponential map will give you some point. It will map this initial velocity vector into the endpoint of the geodesic after it has traveled until its parameter reaches the value 1. Therefore, the components of the tangent vector at the point P become the coordinates of points in the neighborhood of the point P of the manifold. So the exponential map maps from the tangent space of P into a neighborhood in the manifold of the point P. It maps components of the tangent, components of the tangent vector that you may choose, and maps these components, which live in Rn, into points of the manifold. And the nice thing about this is that there is no human choice in this. This is intrinsic. It is canonical. This is a coordinate system that is canonical to the manifold. Unlike other coordinate systems that you may just choose on a whim. Mm. This coordinate system around the point P is called a normal or geodesic coordinate system. It's not quite unique because you can always choose another basis in your tangent space, and then your coefficients psi i will be slightly different. So it's only unique up to rotation, up to a change of basis more generally, in the tangent space. Now this geodesic coordinate system has a These geodesic coordinate systems have a special property. Remember that the endpoint of the geodesic that starts out with velocity psi and runs until its parameter reaches lambda is the same as the endpoint that the geodesic map gives you if you feed it the tangent vector lambda psi. Because lambda psi is the inertial velocity, and then you run the exponential map means run the geodesic until its parameter reaches 1. But we know that it doesn't matter whether you multiply the initial velocity vector with lambda, or you run your exponential map, you run your tangent until its parameter reaches the value lambda. So we have this equality here. But that means now something geometric. What is this? This is the position of the geodesic as its the geodesic that starts out with velocity psi, as its parameter, as its intrinsic parameter, has the value lambda. And for the value lambda equal to 0, we are home. We are at the point P. And as lambda runs through negative or positive values, we run through a geodesic. So we're running
point P.
Yes, all our geodesics that we consider here start at the point P. And so if we look at one particular one of those, here is where the geodesic is for negative values of lambda, lambda equals zero, positive values of lambda. Okay? And generally speaking, it's some curve. In some, if you look at it in some arbitrary coordinate system, it generally comes out crooked. Now, what do we have here? We have here that the progress of our geodesic, as far as the exponential map is concerned, is simply multiplying the psi vector with lambda. But the psi vector is directly the coordinates of the points that we deal with. Which is to say that as the geodesic progresses in the coordinates, in the geodesic coordinate system, in the normal coordinate system, all we have to do is to take this as the coordinates of the point. So in the geodesic coordinate system, all the geodesics are straight line. Because they have, what are the coordinates of our geodesic? At the point lambda equals zero, the coordinates are 0, 0, 0, 0. Lambda times psi is 0, 0, 0, 0, if lambda equals 0. And then as lambda reaches the value 1, for example, we have simply psi. Yeah, it's just over there in between. It's just straight. It's just a straight line, just multiplicatively. So the output of all of this is all geodesics running through the origin of a normal coordinate system are straight lines in a geodesic coordinate system. You see how this encodes the equivalence principle, the idea that you get special relativity if you only choose your coordinate system right.
So can you still, kind of a naive question. Can you still shift your coordinate system so that it's centered around kind of the event or an object?
Yes, you can do that around every point P. But keep in mind that
it doesn't work. There are two points that are event.
No, you can't. That's right. If you choose, of course, another point there, then you can always find a coordinate system, a geodesic coordinate system, such that one geodesic runs through both, and it's a straight line. But in general, the best you can do is to choose a coordinate system, namely a normal coordinate system, such that the geodesics are all straight lines that go through this one point. You can do it for every point, but then even a geodesic that doesn't run through this point, but nearby, generally is already crooked.
What I don't understand is how today,
there was a question before.
Why is it called the exponential? Is it like a? Is it more like a graphical thing? Because if we, I can just see that if we add, if we multiply the exponential, we would get the, we would get the normal vector addition.
Of
course, that would be precise.
E to the power of a d by dx of f of x at you see that? There's a Taylor expansion here. Okay, so if you translate something by a constant, you can view it as the operation of an exponentiated derivative. And there is a way of doing it for the curved space as well. And that's the origin why you call this the exponential map. But it's not particularly useful to do it this way. So we just define it in this way. I think it's much easier than working with the state expansion. But there is. There are generalizations of Taylor expanding in curved space.
Why is it that that chart gives a straight line from the curve lines above?
Well, as I said, it's because if you multiply the coordinates of a point by a factor lambda, you are simply moving further along the geodesic. So the coordinates just change by lambda. Just follow the calculations that we did. Okay, now, in the geodesic coordinate system, the geodesics through the point P, well, in a geodesic coordinate system centered about P, the geodesics that go through the point P are straight lines of constant velocity xi. That's what we just showed. Does this mean that gamma, the Christoffel symbol, is zero? One might think so.
But it doesn't mean that. Let's look at the geodesic equation at the point P in a geodesic coordinate system. Then what we have is that the second derivative is vanishing because, remember that geodesics that run through the point P in a geodesic coordinate system are straight lines of constant velocity xi. Now, as the time parameter, as the t parameter proceeds, you simply linearly change the coordinates xi. So there's no acceleration. Therefore, in a, for a geodesic that runs through the origin of a geodesic coordinate system, that term drops out. We are only left with this. This is the geodesic equation now. And this we might want to mean that the Christoffel symbol has to vanish. But it doesn't, because the Christoffel symbol has a symmetric component and an anti-symmetric component. Remember, we did the decomposition just two slides before. And what this equation means is merely that the anti, that the symmetric component of the Christoffel symbol vanishes, because this anti-symmetric component contracted with this product here is vanishing anyway. Even if the anti-symmetric component of the Christoffel symbol is very large, has very large component, in other words, even if torsion is large, you won't see it in the geodesic equation because any anti-symmetric tensor here contracted with this symmetric combination will give us zero anyway. So the only thing that we obtain here is that the symmetric part of the Christoffel symbol vanishes, but that's no surprise. We know that the Christoffel symbol is not a tensor. You can choose a coordinate system in which the Christoffel symbol is in which a symmetric part is vanishing. That's what it says here. Okay, so what we find here is that in a geodesic coordinate system, at the origin of this coordinate system, the symmetric part of the Christoffel symbol is vanishing. So what we want is that, so we want more than that, we want that the entire, this is what I call the extended equivalence principle. We want that under all circumstances, there's no way that this thing contributes anything. So we don't want that any pseudo forces or tidal forces can show up at or near the origin of a geodesic coordinate system. And so we may want to impose that the anti-symmetric part, that is to say the torsion, also vanishes, just to complete this gap in a way. And I invite you to study this issue in an essay. There are many other reasons for why torsion is probably not present in nature, but it's not trivial at all. And you should not be satisfied with this argument. After all, famous people, among them Einstein, have spent many, many years trying to work out what role torsion might play. After all, the mathematics says Christoffel symbol could have an anti-symmetric part. So why would it be vanishing? And more importantly, what would force it to vanish? I mean, quantum theoretically, anything that is possible will be happening, at least with some amplitude. So it might be worth considering this possibility anyway. And one of the early ideas was that the anti-symmetric part of the Christoffel symbol, the torsion, might have to do with electromagnetism. That was Einstein's hope. At the time, early on, no other forces were really known. it was still conceivable that the nuclear forces are really ultimately electromagnetic. So he thought he could reach an ultimate all-unifying theory by combining gravity with electromagnetism. Gravity would be the symmetric part of the Christoffel symbol, and electromagnetism would be the antisymmetric part. Nature is certainly not that way. Torsion might still play a role, but it's not electromagnetism at all. So now we come to curvature. Assume that we have three tangent vectors now. Then the curvature map is defined to map those three tangent vectors into one tangent vector. You remember the torsion map was mapping two tangent vectors into a tangent vector. And the curvature takes three tangent vectors. I'll explain to you in a moment why that might be. The curvature map is mapping three tangent vectors into what you get when you take the cobound derivative one way or the other way with psi one. First cobound derivative with respect to psi two, then with respect to psi one, minus the other way around, minus the cobound derivative in the direction of the commutator, and you apply all that after psi three. Roughly speaking, maybe I'd give it away already. Roughly speaking, why we need three is the following. We're dealing with parallel transport of vectors, and we are parallel transporting in order to find out whether there's curvature. The crucial idea behind curvature is take an arbitrary direction vector and then parallel transport it along a parallelogram, a small parallelogram. And then when you come back to your starting point, ask, how much has your direction vector rotated because of the presence of curvature? So in order to do this exercise, you need three tangent vectors. You need, first of all, the tangent vector that you are parallel transporting around the parallelogram. And then you need two tangent vectors to specify the parallelogram, the two sides of it. That's why there are three tangent vectors in the game here. So this defines for us the curvature tensor R, which will be a 1-3 tensor. One-fold contravariant and three-fold covariant. Again, we specify what this tensor does by specifying what it does when you satisfy all of its entries with corresponding co- and contravariant vectors. So the Riemann curvature tensor, the curvature tensor can feed on one cotangent vector that will be contracted with this, and three contravariant vectors that will be eaten up with the three covariant components over there. Namely, you take the three contravariant vectors, feed them into the curvature map, get out a tangent vector, which you then evaluate against this covector. That will give you a number, and that's the outcome.
If I was asked your definition of the curvature map, I would just use the first two terms. So I would use the first commutator. So what's the third one?
I will only give you a preview, and the clean thing I'll show you in a moment, and then you will see why we need it exactly the way it is. Okay. It's not supposed to be obvious at this point. So how does it look like in the chart? So we just use the definition we're going to state.
And we feed, as the vectors in question, we feed those basis vectors. Again, we don't have to, and later on we will make other choices. But for now, let's make those simple choices here that come with a chart. So we feed it those tangent vectors here, and then we have to evaluate those the commutator of those covariant derivatives, and then the covariant derivative in the direction of the commutator. How's that? Now we know what those individual covariant derivatives are in terms of the Christoffel symbol, so we can write them out like that. And one convenient thing about choosing those basis vectors is that they commute, those partial derivatives commute. That wouldn't be the case, as I said, if we chose some non-trivial basis vectors, which could be expressed as some non-trivial coefficient functions in front of those basis vectors, and then that would pick up some contributions over here. But with this simple choice, that term just goes away. But later on, we will see that really we need the whole thing. And then, so we have this, and this we have to evaluate that differentiation now on those terms here. And you see that the covariant derivative will have to work on the Christoffel symbols, which are functions, and those things, which are basis vectors. So we get two contributions here by the Leibniz rule. And if we just differentiate this in this way, we obtain, when we apply this to this function, it's just an ordinary derivative. Remember that the covariant derivative on a function is an ordinary derivative. And if we apply the covariant derivative on one of those basis vectors, then we get a Christoffel symbol. So we get from each one of those, we get two terms. One is going to be linear in gamma, and the other one quadratic in gamma. And these are the terms. This whole thing is just a function, a zero form, if you like, a function, multiplied with some basis vector, which we did contract with this basis vector. So overall, we obtain this expression for the curvature tensor. So what we see here is that this expression in terms of the Christoffel symbols, which are themselves not tensors, is actually a tensor. We haven't proven that it is a tensor, but one can show that. One interesting observation might be this. Remember that we can always choose at every point of the manifold a geodesic coordinate system around it. And then we know that at the origin of the geodesic coordinate system, at the point B, the gamma will vanish. But if gamma vanishes, doesn't that mean that the curvature vanishes? It doesn't, because we have derivatives of gamma here. See? Those things are not derivatives of the gammas. This goes away. Those terms survive, even at the origin of a geodesic coordinate system. And by the way, that makes geodesic coordinate systems very useful for practical calculations. Because if you want to do something like a Taylor expansion or so around the point of the manifold, choose geodesic coordinate systems. Believe me, that's your choice. Because if you do, gamma is zero. You may still have to work with those guys, the derivatives of gamma, but not with gamma. So you're really cutting down on a lot of terms if you do that.
Yes, we're doing without functional rank. That's right, otherwise it would work.
Now, what is the meaning of the curvature tensor? Coming back to what we really set out to do, are we really capturing how the parallel transport of a vector around a parallelogram is non-trivial? Here's some intuition. The curvature tensor contains derivatives of gamma, as we saw. And that means it expresses a variation in pseudo forces and in gravitational forces. It expresses how those forces change from one place to the other. Right? The gamma expresses how strong the gravitational field is, or how strong the forces are that you feel due to acceleration. This is what gamma expresses. And the fact that we can always choose a coordinate system in which this vanishes is simply to say that we can always choose a freely falling coordinate system in which acceleration simply offsets what gravity would do. But we can always do this only at the point. We can only make gamma vanish at the point in general. Now, the curvature tensor, however, contains more than just gamma. It contains the derivatives of gamma, which means it knows how gamma changes from one point to the other. It knows how those pseudo forces change. And that cannot be suppressed. That cannot be made to vanish by choice of coordinates. So what this does is the Riemann curvature tensor expresses the so-called tidal forces. It expresses, for example, when a body such as the moon comes too close to a big planet like the Earth, then it's ripped apart. And that is essentially because the part of the moon that is closer to the Earth experiences stronger forces than the part of the moon that is further away. Or to put it differently, they would have different orbital frequencies. So the whole thing is ripped apart. Poor moon is going into pieces. It can't be all that much closer to the Earth without being ripped apart. Now that process of stars being ripped apart or planets being ripped apart actually plays out quite a bit in the universe. Tidal forces are important. In fact, the tidal forces are what keep the moon always facing, showing the same face to us. It's also that. Because the moon is deformed, and it is not really a sphere or an ellipsoid, and it would require a deformation of the moon to have it rotate, having it show us a different face, a different side. And that is what it's resisting. So curvature is an expression also of the tidal forces. Geometrically speaking, that's not what we set out to show. We set out to show that curvature expresses the non-commutativity of two parallel transports. Whether I first parallel transport in this direction, then in that direction, or the other way around, should not be the same. Or put it this way, if I follow a parallelogram this way, that way, and then negative the first direction, and then negative the second direction, I arrive back at the same point that I started with, but possibly with the rotation of a vector that I may have transported along.
The Riemann curvature tensor describes how the pseudo forces change. That means how they change from point to point from the manifold.
Okay. That's right. Curvature describes how gravitational or pseudo forces change from place to place. So now here's the proposition, the so-called Ricci identity. Assume that the torsion vanishes and that psi is a vector field. Then the following holds. The covariant derivative of a vector field psi in the directions c and then d minus the other way around is given by the Riemann curvature tensor contracted with this. So,
the second covariant derivative, first covariant is differentiated in the direction of in the d by dx d direction, and then covariant is differentiated in the d by dx c direction minus the other way around. So as we go through the parallelogram, that gives us this, the Riemann curvature tensor contracted with this. So in particular, if the Riemann curvature tensor vanishes, there's no curvature, then as we do this commutator of the two covariant derivatives, we get the same thing. Two covariant derivatives commute. Two covariant derivatives of a vector field commute if the curvature is vanished. So remember that the partial derivatives, d by dxi, d by dxj, always commute on the manifold, but not the covariant derivative. And that's caught by the Riemann curvature tensor. Concretely now, this was, I gave you some intuition for it. Let's look at this. It implies that for parallel transport along an infinitesimal parallelogram, and that's a little bit messy to derive, but you can look it up, for example, in the text by Stewart or another text by Einstein that I have on
the course hall page, and also in the text by Straumann, I think.
You see, you have to do a Taylor expansion. You have to hear your covariant differentiating at the same point twice, just in different directions. But if you want to do this calculation with a parallelogram, you do a Taylor expansion to get you to this point, and then you do a differentiation over there, that expansion there, to do differentiation. You see, you have to move everything a little bit. And so you have to do the checking order as you do your Taylor expansion. What you can show is that if you take your vector psi and parallel transport it in the direction of eta, and then parallel transport it in the direction of mu, and then back minus eta, and then back minus mu, you're arriving back at the original point. But the vector has turned into the vector psi hat as you parallel transport it, no longer pointing in the same direction. And the difference between the starting direction and the direction of that the vector had after the trip that it took, that difference vector is to lowest order in the approximation, which means to linear order in this, linear order in that, is given by the first direction vector eta contracted with the Ricci curvature tensor, the second direction vector contracted mu, contracted with, sorry, not Ricci, the Riemann curvature tensor. And then you're left with, so the B and the C indices are taken up by this contraction. And then you are left with those two open indices, A and B. It's a matrix. It's a two-component matrix. It's a two-index matrix, right? I mean, like any matrix, two indices. It describes a rotation. It describes how that vector changes. So you take the vector that you are parallel transporting, the psi, and apply this matrix to it, R, A, D, and you obtain the change that it underwent. Technically, technically, you now see what the Riemann curvature tensor really does, what its components do. You have to choose a parallelogram, which is to say you choose two vectors, eta and mu. You contract them with the first two indices of the Riemann curvature tensor. The outcome of that is the matrix RAD, and it is an infinitesimal rotation. If you contract it with a vector that you're parallel transporting, you get its change. So the Riemann curvature tensor has in this way a direct interpretation. Let me perhaps leave the proof of the Ricci identity to you. Let us take a little time, a little exercise with a given solution right away. Now, let us look at the Bianchi identity. Bianchi identities are automatic relations that hold for the torsion and for the curvature by construction. It's not something that is a law of nature that we impose on the basis of observation. But rather, those things follow automatically if only the language applies. If we are using the right mathematics, those things are automatic. Just like the homogeneous Maxwell equations, which were simply expressing that the field strength was an exact form. So if you apply D to it, it is vanishing. So for that purpose, we need the covariant derivative as a map. Consider an arbitrary linear map, and I mean FM linear, which means that you can multiply with any function and the outcome will be multiplied with this function. So you multiply any input of our function with of our map with any function, any zero form, and then that means simply that the output of our map will also be multiplied by that. So K is a map, consider any arbitrary map K, which takes R tangent vectors as input and gives you something as output, which is a tangent vector, in such a way that if you multiply one of those input vectors with a scalar function, with some element of lambda zero, with some zero form, if you multiply any one of those with a function, then the outcome is simply that you can pull this function in front of the case. That is what is meant by an FM linear map. Then what is such an FM linear map? It maps in this case here, an arbitrary contravariant R tensor, any combination of R tension vectors into a tension vector. We can view K also as a tensor. Remember, we viewed tensors as maps, and maps can be viewed as tensors simply by interpreting any covariant component as something that can feed on a contravariant component and the other way around. And feeding on means you can take it as an input and you get some output. So and we can view this K also as a K tilde, which is now a tensor. This was a map. K tilde is a tensor. What it does is it feeds on R contravariant components, and it gives you a tangent vector. And that is just the same thing as this map over here. A 1-3 tensor does just that. It can accept R contravariant vectors as input and gives you a tangent vector as output. Or you can feed it R tangent vectors and 1 cotangent vector and will give you a number. Namely, in this way. It feeds on R tangent vectors and 1 cotangent vector and will give you the number that you obtain by taking the map. Here, this one, which gives you a tangent vector, and then evaluate it against this cotangent vector. Just in the same way that we defined the torsion map and its relation to the torsion tensor and the curvature map and its relation to the curvature tensor. And of course, those will be special cases of where we want to apply our covariant derivative on maps. See, we defined the covariant derivative on tensors already. Now our aim is to view the tensors as maps and then have the covariant derivative act on those maps. Which is not the difficult thing, because we know we can view every tensor as a map and every map as a tensor. So the idea is simply that the usual covariant derivative of the tensor K tilde induces for us the covariant derivative of the map K. So K was a map. And we had not defined what its covariant derivative in a particular direction should be. And we simply define now that the covariant derivative of the map K is that thing which evaluates against omega in such a way that it matches exactly what you get when you covariantly differentiate the tensor K tilde. So K tilde is this. Is a tensor. It feeds on 1 covector and vectors. And we can differentiate this thing covariantly. And this thing is defined. The covariant derivative of the map is simply defined in such a way that it gives us exactly the same output. Now, when we apply covariant derivatives in this way to maps, then we can derive the following two Bianchi identities. First of all, this Riemann curvature map summed over all of its cyclic permutations. So this is the sum over R of psi eta nu plus R of nu psi eta plus R of eta nu psi, eta nu psi, right, is equal to, and here again we have the cyclic permutation of all the three vectors, psi, eta, and nu. And here we have the torsion map. And here we have this notion of the derivative of the torsion map. It's not obvious, it's not supposed to be obvious why that equation is called true. predicate to this. And the second Bianchi identity takes this form. Here it's an identity for the curvature tensor. You notice already that for general relativity, the torsion will vanish, and this thing will simplify, of course. The whole thing will be zero here. And we will have a simple equation here for the Riemann curvature tensor, or the Riemann curvature map. Now, you may wonder, why on Earth? Where do they come from? Okay. Where do those things come from? Let me give you another example of Bianchi identities. We already had one, and that example was the Maxwell equation, the homogeneous Maxwell equation. I'll give you another Bianchi identity. Namely, you may have seen this, that AB, comma C plus C B, comma A. Plus, and you see, I'm just moving things cyclically here. So I moved, let's see, what exactly did I do? I CAB here, right? CAB, and then it should be here BCA is zero, right? Okay. Now, the interesting thing is that this equation, while it might look non-trivial, it's actually trivial because no matter what you use here, it's always true. Because you just write it out, what these things are, and everything just cancels. It's a trivial thing. As soon as you have that A, B, and C are elements of an associative algebra, this just follows. As it happens, that's what this is. So let's see how that happens. Let's prove the first Bianchi identity for the simpler case when there's no torsion. And then you can see how that might arise. It's just a cyclic permutation, right? Just like this is cyclic, it's a cyclic sum. That's a cyclic sum over here. See, remember that was the full equation over here. Cyclic sum is equal to that stuff. The assumed torsion to vanish. And we obtain that if we write this thing out, if you remember, that was the Riemann curvature map. It is this expression here plus cyclic stuff. And then unfortunately, very short of time here. And you just go through those calculations here. You have to use what the covariant derivative really does. We had all those equations before, and you will find that ultimately what this really is psi comma eta nu plus psi k. It's exactly this, except that in this case here, they are not matrices or operators. Well, they are operators. They map functions on functions. And if you just spell out what this is explicitly, you see that all the terms drop out. For every positive term, there's a negative one. So this is true because the algebra of vector fields is an associative algebra. It's much more messy to prove that sort of thing for the case of the presence of curvature. In the case of the presence of torsion. So we're out of time. Let me just make it just a sec. Let me just make one final comment. Just to make you perhaps more interested in pursuing this essay topic of torsion or not, namely, torsion can also be viewed as doing the following. When you do a parallelogram, we assume so far that if you travel psi in this direction and then eta in that direction and then minus psi in this direction and minus eta in this direction, that you arrive at the same point where you started. And then we said, if you parallel transported a vector on your travels, its direction might have changed. The thing is that the first assumption is non-trivial already. It's a non-trivial assumption that after your trip on a parallelogram, you arrive at the same point that you started from. And if you have torsion, you may not arrive back where you started. Eduardo?
My question was if my previous question would be answered by imposing that thing, the Jacobi identity for linear maps, and then seeing that the Riemann map, the map must have that component for this to happen.
Oh, I see. Yes, that might work. Yes, I'm not sure, but I see.
I'm just desperate. This is not my.
That's probably true. Yes, it's probably true that if you define the Riemann curvature map without that extra term there, then one of two things might happen. Either the Bianchi identity may not hold in the form that it stands, or it may not hold at all. There may not be a Bianchi identity, I don't know. Yeah. I mean,
in fact, yes, of course it won't. Because it won't be a tensor if you do it this way.
But it will do much more with the Riemann curvature tensor when you see all these many properties and they work. Yes?
So if you begin at a certain point and then travel around a parallelogram, it will end up at the same point, this portion. But if you travel in the opposite direction, we'd be dealing with three separate points that you could end up at?
Opposite direction. Yes.
Clockwise.
Actually, I don't know that. It's an interesting. Well, let me see. What. Yeah, probably we end up with three points, but I would imagine that there's a very simple relationship between those two points that you might be occupied. And yes, there ought to be, and it's probably some simple expression in terms of the torque. Then, that'd be interesting to explore these things.
I was planning on doing the Hamiltonian formula.
Yeah, I think the Hamiltonian formula is an essay topic, is the simplest one in a way, because it's an area textbook. It's easy. So it's the easiest topic, but if you want a challenge, to
well, now that there's a challenge.
Any other questions?
I have one about the size of the geodesic coordinate. How many? Okay, you were saying that you could not extend the geodesic coordinates too far because they might cross.
Yes.
Okay. But say that you have like a compact region of a manifold,
mm-hmm.
then the geodesic coordinate systems are open sets, and if they cover the so it's finite, so the you can cover them finite.
Yes, you can cover the entire manifold with local geodesic coordinates.
Okay, and a finite and a discrete number of them, so there won't be many crossings. I mean. If you have a compact, it will be. There
well,
will be
actually, I'm not sure that you can always do it with a finite number of geodesic coordinate systems. You may need an infinite number of geodesic coordinate systems.
If it's compact, if every infinite cover has a finite.
Well, that's
cover.
Right. Yes, and you can always make it open set. Yeah, well, that's right. In this case, you can do it. That's right.
So it's not much of a. You can make very large, which for me is strange. To be able to make very large geodesic coordinate systems.
No, it doesn't imply that you can always make large geodesic coordinate systems. It just means that you can have a set of geodesic coordinate systems that overlap and in total cover the entire manifold. But remember that just because you have a geodesic coordinate system here covering that patch and another one covering this patch and they may be overlapping, it doesn't mean that everything is trivial in this larger patch now.
Okay.
And in any case, the Christoffel symbol vanishes only at the origin of the geodesic coordinates. And the geodesics are straight lines only if they go through the origin of the geodesic coordinates.
Oh, okay.
By the way, when we have long Thursdays in the future and do those double sessions, I could bring things from Tim Horton, but I didn't see much enthusiasm about that. There's another possibility. You could have our breaks in the distro. They have half an hour from 5 to 8, I think. And it doesn't mean that they have your beer. I think what they offer is for $4. Basically, either a vegetarian or a meat-based light dinner. So maybe I'll bring some sweets, and if you want something more solid, it's also available.